Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. This is part three, I believe, of the cult miniseries that we're doing. And today we're looking to get sued and we're talking about Scientology. And I am joined once again by Stelios Panayotou. Got your second name right
this
time.
Thank you. Yeah, you did.
Thank you very much. And BB Dade, also known as Bo Dade. I don't have any more nicknames for you. I'm not going to do the same twice, but I've got to come up with one at some point. And yes, we're going to be looking at what Scientologists actually believe, as well as the structure of their organization, which seems to be very exploitative, is my kind of summary of everything that's going on here. But it is actually insane. The past couple of cults we've looked at, I've tried to be a bit charitable. That's over with. Like, Scientology, it's obviously a full-blown cult. You know, the word cult is kind of epitomized by Scientology, I think. And the fact that it's such an organized thing, the fact that they sue people into oblivion for criticizing them, means, in my mind, that they are utter scum and deserve no sympathy whatsoever. And we are going to tear them a new one, basically. So I hope you enjoy us being horrible about insane people, because I'm going to talk about the life of L. Ron Hubbard, and it reads like the script of a comedy. It's unbelievably... I was reading it and just like, surely this isn't all true. And then I look it up. I check the sources, like I checked his military records and things like that with the official Navy, US Navy sources, and compared it to the Church of Scientology website. And it's just like, oh, right, so they're just lying about him. He's not this great man. He's actually one of the biggest losers I think I've ever read about, ever. And I'm not saying that to be hyperbolic. I actually mean it. So let's get on to his life, shall we? Because I get the impression that neither of you know especially much about Scientology. So I'm going to fill you in.
Anything other than some, let's say, famous people who are affiliated with it, like Tom Cruise yeah, and John Travolta.
Mm-hmm. No, I know a fair bit, and I know a fair bit about the life of L. Ron Hubbard.
Okay.
So yeah, I've never read Dianetics.
No, nor have I.
But yeah, I know a reasonable amount. But okay. I'm looking to learn something here. I'm sure
you will.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Mm-hmm.
So it's also worth mentioning as well. I might forget to mention it later, that the reason that so many actors and actresses seem to be involved in Scientology is that they've got like a recruitment scheme whereby, if you agree to do the Scientology stuff, they put you through acting school and things like that.
Okay, I didn't know that.
So they basically try and buy people in Hollywood, but it's like a poison chalice in that, sure, you might make it in the film industry, but then you owe a considerable amount of money to the Church of Scientology, and if you leave, they will harass you, stalk you, defame you, all sorts of stuff, but I don't really care about that, so let them try. So let's start with L. Ron Hubbard, shall we? He was born in 1911 to a teacher and a Navy officer, so one would imagine that's quite comfortable, especially for 1911. Those are big, good professions. So you'd imagine he had a reasonable, stable upbringing, but he did move around a lot because of his father's role in the Navy, so it seemed like I think that does shape how people kind of perceive the world and how they carry themselves. You can kind of tell when someone's moved around a lot because they tend to be a bit more introverted, maybe. They're not nearly as personable as someone who stayed in the same place. And that's not really their fault, obviously.
I think kids, especially little kids, do need stability, some sort of stability. So if you are moving around constantly in your sort of younger formative years, it's probably not ideal. It's not necessarily a problem. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have psychological issues in adulthood. But yeah, it's probably not ideal. Wasn't he born in Nebraska? Is that right?
Somewhere like that, yeah.
All right, okay. It's not a classic naval place for naval officers to be, is it, Nebraska? But, all right, anyway.
But supposedly, when he was in school, in the sophomore year of high school, he gets bad grades, and then in the junior year, he gets held back and then drops out of his second attempt. And then he attempts to join the Navy Academy and fails. And then he attends a course at a YMCA, which was called Woodward High, if you're interested, and gets reasonable passing grades so he can finally finish high school. And this doesn't come across as some sort of religious messiah so far, does it? So he somehow manages to get to George Washington University. He was there for 2 years, but gets bad grades and drops out. And whilst he was there, he joined the Marine Reserves. And he served for 5 weeks before being discharged. And the military records, which people have since been able to view, show that he was coded as not for re-enlistment. Basically, yeah, this guy is incapable of doing the job.
Bad at taking orders, I guess.
I wouldn't say necessarily the taking orders part. More so, he was a bit stupid.
Okay.
I think it's fair to say. So... He did stay in D.C. after he dropped out of university and
Sorry, just to put this into context, this is before World War II, are we talking?
Yes. Yeah, long before.
Okay.
I think it's between World War I and World War II. So he stayed in D.C. and befriended a bunch of psychiatrists, which gave him lots of insights into the profession. He managed to see some like mental health wards, I suppose you can call them. That's what they'd be called in the modern day. They probably had a different name back then. But he kind of got embedded in that world for a little while, although he was somewhat encouraged because one of the psychologists he befriended had a belief that you didn't need a piece of paper to qualify you to be a psychiatrist. Anyone can really do it as long as they've got the ability to do it, which I'm somewhat sympathetic towards, but also I think the whole notion of psychiatry is nonsense as well. So, of course, I'm not going to think it's very hard to qualify because it's a load of pseudoscience and it's, you know, oh, we're going to hypnotize you and you're going to get, you know, these suppressed memories bubble up to the surface. Never mind the fact that when you hypnotize someone, you make them suggestible. So you can implant false memories in them quite easily of, oh, I've got this very vague recollection of this thing happening to me and it's provably false. These sorts of methods are nonsense in my view and more harm than good. Just worth saying. So fast forwarding to 1933, he married and would go on to father some children. It's not really too pertinent. I've tried to keep it very bare bones because, you know, the details of his life aren't as interesting as how his life has shaped how he formed Scientology. So he and his family were very poor, and Hubbard started writing fiction stories, which he seemed to be relatively good at. So by 1940, he'd written hundreds of short stories that he'd basically been writing for pulp fiction magazines, which of course now is sort of synonymous with Quentin Tarantino's film, but it is of course borrowed from the sort of magazines with cheap pulpy paper rather than anything else, rather than the glossy ones which were seen as more expensive. So he'd also written a few full-length novels, the first of which was published in 1937. I think it was about a blonde-haired person who'd been accepted by the Blackfoot tribe or something like that. So it's sort of Native American themed story, but it was well received by the New York Times, which I think certainly helped his career, because by this point they were sort of tastemakers in literature, which they still are to some extent today. So on New Year's Day 1938, he had a reaction to dental anesthetic gas in what was a routine procedure, and he claims that this triggered a revelatory near-death experience, which, as far as religious experiences go, the dental chair, I'm not so sure, because having been put under anaesthetic at the dentist, it didn't feel like a religious experience. It just felt weird. I didn't feel transcendent at all. I suppose it was the near-death part. I think he had a bad reaction to it, and so that might be why he came close to death and it kind of revealed to him some aspect of life. But it's not entirely clear what actually happened here. I wasn't able to dig up any more details about it.
This is new to me. I didn't know that part of his life, actually. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. But it seems like the first sort of inclination of some sort of religious experience, I suppose you could say.
I don't know if it is religious or not, but I think that very frequently people talk about experiences they had, and there are two ways to think of it. There are more, but I think one way is to take that experience at face value, and the other is to have a more third person approach to it and try and find out, you know, what happened. Were there something in the brain that could trigger such an experience or alter it? There's always the element of interpretation of it. So I really don't know what to say on this, mm-hmm. but I think that this is where there will be divergence in ways that people proceed to understand such experiences. Because I've heard a lot about people who talk about near-death experiences, and I really don't know what to make of them, because it seems to me that, for instance, when people talk about being in a coma for years and then they have zero brain activity, but then it's the brain starts functioning a bit. Well, I mean, probably it's the brain. But there's a propensity to people to want to claim that somehow they are special. And I think that a lot of people who have been associated with cults, they don't go out telling them that I'm basically nobody. They try and create an elevate image of themselves.
Hubbard certainly did that, and lots of accounts of people he knew him personally said that he was rather full of himself, despite having absolutely no reason to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've had a few near-death experiences just because I'm stupid sometimes. And yeah, they're just horrible. I don't know why anyone says, it was like a religious experience. I'm not sure that's what he was claiming necessarily, but it changed his perspective in some way. But no, it's just thoroughly unpleasant. It reminds you of your mortality. It's not nice. It doesn't feel like a religious experience. It feels like something that's quite sort of dehumanizing in a sense. It's just like, oh, right, so death can find you at any moment. Like, there was a time where I nearly choked on some steak. So I had, like, steak fat, and it was quite long. I tried to chew it, but I couldn't chew it down, and so I tried to swallow it, and it got a bit stuck.
Yeah.
I shouldn't laugh.
It is funny.
Sorry, I've had the same thing with some bacon. Nearly suffocated to death on some bacon. Yeah, anyway, sorry, carry on.
The things we love can turn out to kill us. It's terrible. But no, I just thought, my final moment's going to be in a Toby Carvery. Which, if you're in Britain, it doesn't have, you know, it's seen as a little bit proletarian, I think is a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, I've heard many people say who didn't buy into L. Ron Hubbard's persona that he was just extraordinarily arrogant. But I think that near-death experiences, any sort of general anaesthetic, or it's even sometimes just dreams, any sort of psychedelic experience, everyone experiences it a bit different. You know how sometimes people can witness the same event and they walk away and their eyewitness testimony is completely different, pretty much completely different. Or we get it in comments on things, that people hear different things, almost, to what you're saying. They disagree on what you've just said. And it's like, it's right there, the evidence right there of what was said and what wasn't said. And people are arguing about what was said. So when it comes to something like a psychedelic experience or a near-death experience or anything like that, even dreams, sometimes some people are going to take away from it what seems like a sort of a wildly extrapolated conclusions about what they experienced. I just think that is sort of that happens all the time.
And to be somewhat charitable to him, he was probably feeling a bit funky from the anaesthetic, and he did nearly die because he had a reaction to it. So if you've had a reaction when you're not necessarily yourself as well, that's going to kind of elevate that. So, you know, I was poking fun, but I can kind of understand.
It even includes, I would say, even any sort of traumatic experience. It doesn't need to be near death. It doesn't need to be as extreme as that. It doesn't need to be an actual, you know, strong psychedelic experience or anything. It could just be something triggers in your mind that suddenly, for whatever reason, you become sort of painfully aware of your own mortality or something. Someone close to you dies or whatever it is. Or you nearly die. Or you weren't actually injured in any way. Just like, you know, a car nearly hit you. And suddenly something flips in your mind and you're psychologically different from that moment onwards. That sort of happens to us all to various extents.
Very true.
So obviously, I didn't know this event in L. Ron Hubbard's life, but it seems like it was, you could argue it was a fairly pivotal one.
Mm.
Is that what he said?
No, it's just kind of implied that it happened, and perhaps this is like the sort of snowball that started an avalanche.
Mm.
That's kind of the impression that I get might have happened, that it kind of put this seed in his mind that went on to grow, maybe. It's just something to throw in there to kind of get a measure of the man, really. So did you have something to say before?
No, I was saying that it's like with people say that they see light. I mean, in some dreams also, you see them in color. And they say that, you know, I see light, therefore it's like heaven, the doors of heaven opening wide for me to cross. And then they come back to life and they can't make sense of it. It's one way of interpreting things. But I think, as you said, it involves wild extrapolations and seems to be the least plausible way to think of things.
I'm going to quickly fire through some of his naval career.
Can I add something about the beginning?
Sure.
Yeah, because I think that it's really important to say that he was traveling a lot with his family.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that this, as you said, Bo, it is important for stability, because many children who travel around, they feel that they lose their friends and they become scared of attachment. So I'm willing to bet that somehow there is such an issue, or without knowing the case, that there is such an issue of being scared of attachment on the one hand, but also wanting to have an audience to combat loneliness or feelings of loneliness on the other. Because if you want people to be so, somehow like followers of this kind, it seems to me that you hate being alone, basically. Mm-hmm. You want people to love you and adore you.
Well, when you find out his marital history, you will soon find out that you're pretty much spot on the money there. Okay. So in 1941, he joined the US Navy as a lieutenant junior grade in the United States Naval Reserve. He didn't get through perhaps meritocratic means, because of course his father was in the Navy. I think he used his father's connections to get in, and at a rank that he clearly wasn't fit to do. So he was sent to the Philippines via Australia the day after Pearl Harbor, and he was assigned to an intel billet when he arrived. And this is a quote from the US Naval Attaché to Australia, and this is from February the 14th, 1942, so about a year afterwards or so. This officer is not satisfactory for independent duty assignment. He is garrulous and tries to give impressions of his importance. He also seems to think that he has unusual ability in most lines. These characteristics indicate that he will require close supervision for satisfactory performance of any intelligence duty.
So argumentative and arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
Garrulous, sort of argumentative. One thing I would say is that it seems to be, it is the case that lots of the details of his life, I think deliberately, are sort of up for debate. So one thing I read or saw was that the naval records said that during wartime, he never left the continental United States.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But it's also, I know, a big part of his legend that he fought in the Pacific.
He definitely didn't fight in the Pacific.
Well, not fight, sorry. Didn't see combat, but was just, well, in Australia. So 1942, it's the war in the Pacific. Pearl Harbor's December 7th, 1941, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's 1942. So there's full-blown naval combat with the Japanese in the Pacific.
But,
so, I don't think even he claims he saw action or anything in naval engagements.
I'm not even entirely sure he got to Australia. I think he got turned back because he sent an intelligence boat basically 3,000 miles out of the way to nowhere. And they're just like, this is an unacceptable waste of resources. Go back.
So he was an officer.
America.
Right.
He was in charge of stuff.
Right.
Yeah. This officer, and it says at the start of the quote. So he was sent back to the United States because of clearly being incompetent, and was assigned to the command of a naval yard patrol vessel in Massachusetts.
So that's on the East Coast.
Yeah, the other
coast. So get him as far away from action as possible.
So the shipyard's commander stated that Hubbard was not temperamentally fitted for independent command and requested he be immediately relieved of duty. He was, in 1943, he was then put on a sub-chasing vessel, and within 5 hours of being on the vessel and being in command of it, he thought they had encountered an enemy submarine, and then this followed a 68-hour combat ordeal in which it seems like they were chasing ghosts, in a sense. They spent 68 hours in combat, and apparently an investigation found that there was no sub and that Hubbard had mistaken a known iron deposit for a sub, which you would think is kind of 101. If you're, you know, if you're looking for a large metal object, you should probably know where the iron deposits are, because those are going to ping up. I mean, that's... I've never chased a submarine before, but one would presume that, you know, you want to discount the false positives and that it's a possibility. But no, L. Ron Hubbard, he was certain. He knew that there was an enemy submarine because he's L. Ron Hubbard and he's going to get all the action. But it's just ridiculous that they spent 68 hours fighting an imaginary iron deposit. Well, a real iron deposit, but an imaginary submarine, sorry.
See, I've heard a variant on that it was in Oregon, which is on the West Coast still, and it was some sort of floating tree trunk or floating log or something that he thought was a submarine. And again, sort of fired on it. And, well, it's just completely embarrassing, isn't it? It sort of reveals the fact that you don't know what you're doing at all.
I mean,
that you're highly incompetent. Not just a little bit subpar, but nowhere near.
I feel like even if you got someone who knew absolutely nothing about what they were doing, they could still do better than that. I don't know what you think, Stelios, but...
Well, it seems to me that he was panicked. And
maybe, yeah.
Yeah, it's he doesn't seem to be fitted for independent command. But also they say temperamental. It's funny because it more indicates character.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, you know, a mistaken judgment. It's a character assessment that this person is disposed to behave and think that way, rather than just make the occasional mistake.
And to be fair, both people,
mistakes, by the way.
Both people that we've read from so far in the military said similar things, that it's more his personality. He's got the ability, mentally to be capable, but it's just that he doesn't have the disposition to do it. So the final straw for his naval career was that he ordered his crew to fire 4 shells from the ship's 3-inch guns at a number of rifle and pistol shots in the direction of Coronado Island. This island belonged to Mexico, in which he was anchored in their waters, and he fired towards a Mexican naval garrison. And funnily enough, the Mexican government complained to the US government, and he was removed from command because he fired on,
Were they warning shots?
I don't know. I think he was just so rubbish that
Yeah.
They didn't hit anything. There's no... I wasn't able to find an account of any damage or fatalities.
Okay.
But also the notion of you're on a boat moored in the waters, supposedly a far enough distance that you can fire the ship's guns, and you're shooting pistol rounds in the general direction of it.
Like, yeah, that's into the realm... I didn't know this particular incident either. That's in the realm of sort of full-blown craziness. Mm-hmm. He's lucky he wasn't sort of court-martialed and put in prison for something like that.
He should have
been. That's way beyond sort of dereliction of duty or just incompetence. That's a bit mental to me.
He attacked a US ally, yeah.
Yeah. There was a quote, if you scroll back up a little bit, there was a quote from one of them that said earlier in his career that said he should be removed from command. Scroll up a bit more, I think it was. Anyway, he said, I recommend that he be removed from active duty. Oh, that was it. A request that he be immediately relieved of duty. Mm-hmm. That is one step away from saying, yeah, we need to arrest this person.
Yeah.
That's as damning as it gets in the military, in the Navy, that we request is immediately removed from active duty. That's sort of as damning as it can be. Again, you get the picture of the character of the man, not fit to be an officer, let's say.
Panicked. He constantly sees threats all around. He seems to be wanting to use power and exercise
trigger
power.
Trigger happy or something.
Trigger happy.
Three-inch guns are not small. 3-inch guns, that's quite big, really. Like quite large cannon, really. Anyway.
So here's a report about the incident from a rear admiral in Hubbard's investigation. And it says, consider this officer lacking in the essential qualities of judgment, leadership and cooperation. He acts without forethought as to probable results. He is believed to have been sincere in his efforts to make his ship efficient and ready. Not considered qualified for command or promotion at this time. Recommended duty on a large vessel where he can be properly supervised. Which is... very kind, really, considering what had just happened.
Again, where you described him as a loser at the beginning.
Yeah.
But
I think that seems fair. It's like, this guy is a loose cannon, a loser. He needs to be watched at all times. I mean,
this seems to be a comment for a report written by an admiral, a rear admiral.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily that they would have collaborated. They were on the same ship. I think it's the other officer who was the captain of the other ship who had contact with him. And that's a bit more suggestive that when he said that he suggests that he be immediately relieved of duty.
Maybe it says this after an investigation there. So usually if there was a big investigation, you'd get someone from senior brass to sort of oversee an investigation. If 3-inch guns were fired against an ally, that's sort of fairly serious. Even if they didn't hit anything. You get that all through his life. People that don't owe him anything, that haven't bought into his persona and everything. And they give a sort of a real judgment. Just say things like that repeatedly, don't they?
And I think from this point onwards, he basically complained of lots of health issues and tried to weasel his way out of being in the military altogether. And eventually he left the military, and rather than returning to his family, he stayed in California, and he befriended the occultist rocket engineer Jack Parsons, who you may have heard of already. Actually, I had heard of him before, who was a follower of Aleister Crowley, and he also became involved, even though he moved into the mansion of Jack Parsons. He became involved with his girlfriend, who was 21 years old. By this point, he was married and had a child, by the way. He hadn't seen them since he'd been in the military. And apparently, they collaborated on a sex magic ritual in an attempt to summon Babylon, which is the premier goddess of Crowley's pantheon. So he was clearly into some weird stuff, but long before Scientology had been invented.
Well, it was for the greater good.
Oh, yeah.
Occult stuff.
It is occult, yeah.
Do either of you know much about Aleister Crowley?
Reasonable amount, yeah. He was English occultist, wasn't he? Yeah.
I've heard some, but not much.
I mean, this isn't about him, but just to briefly say, I don't like Aleister Crowley. I don't buy any of that.
Of course,
Of that stuff at all.
He's a creepy weirdo, yeah.
Reject everything about Aleister Crowley. So the fact that L. Ron Hubbard was sort of a fan, mm-hmm. or around people that followed him, or anything at all like that.
So yes, they did all of this occultist stuff. Insane, obviously. It makes no sense. It's weird, creepy, and degenerate as well. And as if that wasn't enough, Hubbard and Parsons' girlfriend, who became Hubbard's girlfriend, and tried to defraud Parsons of a considerable amount of money in some sort of scheme where they would sail ships across the Pacific. I think this is shortly after the war had finished by this point. And basically they used that as an excuse to defraud him of lots of money because they had no guarantee that they had returned the money that Parsons had put down on the boats back to him, and he was forced to sell his mansion.
Nice.
So yes, he also, Parsons went on to die at the age of about 37, so it seems like it kind of ruined him, but I don't feel too bad for some creepy weirdo occultist. He married Parsons' former girlfriend, despite still being married, and he was also claiming disability allowance. I think this is probably fraudulently, as well as getting a small income from his writing. And in 1947... he wrote to the Veterans Administration asking for an increase in his war pension, and also claimed he needed a psychoanalyst, even though he never actually saw any combat. So he's just a scumbag who's trying to game the system to his own advantage.
A bigamist.
And that as well, yeah.
So he's married to two women there.
Two women. He's
nice.
Stealing money from people, trying to claim that he even deserves a military pension after his appalling track record.
Why were they giving him a pension?
I don't know. He doesn't deserve it though, does he? I suppose because he wasn't dishonorably discharged. He was discharged because of medical stuff. Okay. He's able to claim one. He basically is one of those people that weasels their way through rules to get as much benefit to himself as possible. So in 1948, because he'd been writing lots of science fiction and things like that, he went to a science fiction convention and he said, "Writing for a penny a word is ridiculous. If a man really wants to make $1 million, the best way would be to start his own religion." Thank you for watching that clip from my series Contemplations. If you want to sign up to the website for £5 a month, you can access that series, which comes out 1 p.m. every Saturday. Thank you for watching and goodbye.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Save big money on everything for your next bathroom project. Now at Menards. Upgrade your bathroom with Max. With more than 1,000 showers, bathtubs, and surrounds, you're sure to find exactly what you need to add luxury and style to your bathroom. Save big on our entire selection of Max bathroom products. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.